intersected with gas and fiber optic power connections to campus, and rupture that's probably a result of frost and shifting weather. Be able to respond to that, not an ideal situation. I'm going to turn around and have a limited time that students are able to begin to back up and running. Within a 24-hour period window, we're going to be able to turn water off on the whole campus. Was significant, so I appreciate everybody's energy and efforts in making that happen, from public safety to physical plan, the faculty and staff that assisted with students that were delayed by this class on the first day. But I think to be able to respond and handle that relatively short period of time was good. Again, it's amazing that that happened. The other classes, what happened over 3 weeks ago, was here. But thanks to everybody's efforts for making that happen. A couple of quick things I want to touch on briefly that I want to deal with. Just have a very, very brief update on what's happening with strategic committees. By that, I mean simple, brief event charges of what's happening. And then I want to spend a significant portion of time talking about where we are with enrollment and some general discussions about what we need to think about in terms of our enrollment profile of students and get some feedback from you. So let me make a couple of comments. One, you saw the story about our bond rating. Lori, I think we'll talk a few comments briefly about that in the context of the budget. That's good news. We've climbed back up to stable. The article I thought was good. I thought it focused on enrollment stabilization, which is true that we're able to predict, and we're having a conversation right now about where our enrollment numbers are, rather than we're having a conversation a year from now, once they're already in. That is a change in operational procedure. But I think it gave an impression that our enrollment challenges were solved. That's not the case. But we have certainly made changes to our budget, and in the frankly of our ongoing conversations with S&P, one of the biggest changes is that we are not eating into reserves on a continuous basis, which has been our strategy for at least 5-6 year more period. We didn't do that this year, and I would say that's more of a particular bond designation.
Right. Yep. Yes. The stabilization of the budget, reducing our expenditures, spending within our means, and stabilizing enrollment were the key things.
Being able to predict where things are going to be. Okay. So I just want to ask any questions about that. If you're not planning to bond additional, acquire additional debt for bonding in the future, so it's not a real impact on that. That's good in terms of if we were to affect the rates, but I think it's more of a PR impact in terms of demonstrating what we're doing with our finances. Want to mention the CFE is off and rolling. We have a significant contribution of $500,000. We have $500,000 from the increase trust that we need to show progress on, so if we can lock those down. That's $3 million in terms of our component as it stands now to raise. We still are working with Cloverland and will this very shortly have both teams of engineers to decide on land on a plan for a component of a building that adjoins the canal and structurally what we need to do with that to see what impact that is on our station functionality of the building plan. So that's where we are on track. We have a year and a half to get a finalized plan to the state to put us contingent to do that to make certain we lock down the engineering constraints of the building. The just an update on SIM. We have the hospitals worked out an agreement with the city in terms of parking. The hospital has proposals ready to go out for request for responses to request for proposals for bids. They have a target line of August to potentially having that up and rolling. The next step is we go for us to approve the final stage of the lease agreement that we will have with that building. We will own everything that's movable in the building. They will own the building and branded a Lake State facility. Should be a good opportunity for us to have a footprint downtown, as well as serving our nurses and nursing students, our EMS folks, as well as serving the hospital. And Ron, you're here. you have any comments to add to that?
Not really, we're moving along.
Is it?
That else? I think it's going to be great.
Briefly, I want to comment on HLC, just briefly, and give you an opportunity to provide some input there, David. We have our team visit report back to us, very positive, I'll be very clear, 21 criteria. We met or exceeded all of three. Three we met with some concern and asked for additional time. Assessment, and we need to do some additional regular updates, reports to them on our budget and enrollment regulars. Analysis of where we are, how we're responding to that, our conversations today. So very good. We still need to have a final report, so that team report goes to the HLC, to the final accrediting component of HLC. They will review and respond to them by...
They should review or respond by March, very early April. The one other item they've asked us to follow up on is the definition of credit hours for that we use, you know, whether it's a C class, online class, blended class. Make sure that all of that is uniform. So good news. We've gotten the error admissions report to review in the fall. That got done. We've gotten this preliminary or a draft report now to review, and we concur with those findings. Again, 18 met or exceeded, so that's really good news. There is work to be done, for sure, moving forward. But we should hear back very soon as the Institutional Action Council makes their final determination. They're gathering all reports like this from across the country, making sure that their decisions are uniformly applied.
And we're on the open pathway, and Dave Mike is here. Our next full...
No, it's standard.
Our standard pathway.
Yeah.
Our next full team visit will be 25-26, but we will have interim visits. Is that correct?
There'll be a site visit with assurance argument again in 5 years.
Our full,
the next one. That was assurance argument, and then that's an assurance review, they call that the next full review with federal compliance auditing and assurance argument in 2020.
And as I understand, the last time we went through this, right, when we came in roughly 11-12, they tagged that end date as 15-16. So this extension to 10 years out is a good step.
Any questions about that? We will have, once we get that final report, some type of public release to the community about our review. And I expect that to happen probably in March. So as soon as we get it, we'll work on that.
It needs to be
Academics.
So I'll go ahead and speak to that. That committee is meeting tomorrow with finance to begin their work together. Then a bi-weekly schedule was established just yesterday to begin working on a number of initiatives in that area for assessment, one for that week. And then the other, well, I'll get back and send it. So we're off and running.
Finance, Maureen.
So on the finance committee, they also have a every other week schedule plan, but they're meeting on Friday, joint meeting with the academic committee. Both the academic and the finance committees have a very rough draft of the three-year financial plan. It's not much of a plan at this point, although it is over 30 pages long. It has a lot of information in it. The information will be used then to draft the final plan. So they have that rough draft. The audit was completed, so our auditors finally gave us all the final audit paperwork across all the different sectors of campus and everything that they came to look at. We got that on December 29th. So that will be presented to the Board of Trustees at the next meeting. It's also posted up on the website if you want to go pull down those documents and look at those. We're going to begin budget preparations here shortly. I sent out an email this morning asking for any capital or structural improvements that you may have you're interested in for the next couple of fiscal years, especially focusing on next fiscal year. So if you want to redo this room, we'd like to know about it. It's already on the list. I'll use an example. I made a little comment in there on labs in terms of equipment, the 400 megahertz magnetic resonance machine.
NMR.
Okay, nuclear magnetic. I couldn't remember exactly what type of machine it was. So the NMR machine is a good example. We got that donation. It won't fit in our building, so obviously they'll have a lot of infrastructure needs. And so we want to capture those things ahead of time. If you have any hint that you want an office renovation, a wall put up, a wall torn down, some plumbing, you're going to move a computer lab, and so that's $10,000 for electrical work. We'd like to know about those things. So that's in the email I sent out this morning. The S&P report, just very quickly, that came out. That's a good affirmation that we have made some good decisions in the last year. We turned some things around. We're operating within our means. Those are all good things. But if you read through the report, you can still see that there are some issues that they have at their forefront that we need to keep in front of us and make sure that we maintain our enrollment, we don't overspend, we don't accumulate new debt. And by new debt, I mean long-term bonds. We will accumulate new debt. We just did add new wireless hubs. How many?
100.
100. We just added 100 new wireless connections in Brady Hall.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. Where there, some other location.
Where there were, what, 16?
14.
14. So we went from 14 to many more than 14, all in an effort to improve the student experience in the dorms. And so that's kind of a test bed right now. Most institutions are moving to one wireless per room. So, one wireless hub per room. And so that's where we jumped to that technology here over break. And so we're doing things like that. That did cost us some additional funds. We did lease that product, lease to buy, just as we did the exercise equipment, which should be, and I'm not trying to steal anybody's thunder here, but the exercise equipment also will be here in February 7th. That's the date it's done. Yeah, I think it's coming here before that, hopefully. And a little bit of a lengthy install on the equipment. So we will accumulate some small debt. Those are $150,000 debt issues for leases, but no long-term bonding issues. I think Paul just put out a very lengthy agenda for tomorrow's meeting. I don't know if you want to say anything real quickly on
We'll be meeting finance committee on Wednesday, so we'll be meeting briefly today.
Right, tomorrow is the big meeting with academics.
What's the status of the result of the program?
That would be tomorrow meeting with academics.
So there's several movements I want to just comment on.
no findings, no inappropriate financial activities in terms of the way we treat those programming course fees. Those are, they are in the general fund, and it's up to the institution to determine how the general fund
does. Doesn't mean you want to continue to question asking the auditing firm, when we auditing, like our budgeting, or using financial management violated any type of auditing or financial practice. And that question, the answer is no. Collect those funds and aggregate them the way that we have, that's what we want. This committee makes a recommendation. Third line of analysis of folks who's in charge of the work on property.
So Jen Constantino and Craig Kraut were tasked to do a internal investigation. They looked at a stack of documents, both financial and minutes and board minutes and a number of other things. They talked with the auditors, they talked with a number of staff in the business office, as well as faculty, as well as others. I saw a preliminary report from them a few days ago, sent it back to them to get some clarification. I expect that we'll have that either by tomorrow or Monday at the very latest. My plans are then to submit that report to the Board of Trustees, since they're the ones who charged us to do that in response to a complaint that was filed. So I'll be sharing that with the board and with Dr. Plager. Either one of those groups may request some additional clarification or information, but I think our goal is to have that tied up so that it feeds into the conversation at the board meeting later this
month. I want to be very clear at the board meeting. If you want to come and ask questions, expect the board to ask questions to the auditor, expect those questions to the questions on the audit of the audit firm. Fully audit and respond to questions that occur to come to that meeting. Also, in the case of the HLC report, we were compliant with that. The HLC leadership, they had asked us to hear about this, had some discussion about it. I don't think there was any even discussion of it in their report, which was actually somewhat surprising. But we had a thorough discussion. They also brought it up, and it was in the public venues, had not been talked with the visiting team. So I read the report, I don't remember any specific things about this issue in the report on recommendations. Somewhat surprising.
Right. I do want to say that there is a plan. There is a section within the three-year plan to address the shortfall of the funding on the program and course fees. And the most simplistic of ways that I can think of explaining the auditor's, you know, view of this, it's like a father to children. I'm going to give you an allowance, you know, so there's a household budget, and then the father does not, or the mother does not yield the allowance to the children. Right? It's a broken promise. It's not a good thing. It creates good relationships. You know, people get mad. So it's in the most simplistic kind of way to explain that. Has any law been broken? Have you done anything wrong? Are you going to jail? No, but it's certainly not a good practice. So there is text in the three-year plan to address that and to make that whole.
I appreciate that analogy.
Yeah, you never like me speaking off the cuff, I know.
I like the comparison of father and children. Our active departments and
so just to follow up on that, then, is the timeline that by next budget year we would have this resolved in terms of how program fees are going to be allocated?
The yearly allocation is addressed, and it's wholly distributed. The proposal is a wholly distribution of the acquired fees for that year. The entire deficit, the $1.5 million, no, we cannot come up with $1.5 million to fill that void in 1 year.
So like the ones we're collecting this semester, those aren't going to the departments, correct? Those are still part of this.
The ones that, the departments that requested additional funding for this year.
But the program fees that they're charging their students aren't all being returned to the departments currently?
Correct. The budget requests were less than the amount that's been collected. So that is a true statement, right? The amount allocated for program and course fees for this, actually the entire fiscal year, was less was requested than what was collected.
You did appropriate additional funds.
Right.
So requested.
Yeah. Additional requests have been funded.
Yeah, I won't belabor it. I guess we're getting off the of how departments approve program fees, which was that that as a fund to replace equipment and repairs that may not be this year, but maybe in following years, and you're talking about us having to budget for those unknown things in advance, otherwise we don't keep up those monies, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, I think that's
how do you handle if you have an emergency break?
That's where the thing goes.
So that is a fundamental issue that we have to address. If you have an emergency need, you need to know about it, and we need to decide how we're going to fund that.
Right. That's why there was money held back in the budgets. There was academic reserve and a non-academic reserve. I think there were two cutoffs. But this time we actually put money in those two accounts in the general fund. And so a boiler broke somewhere. We fixed it. The water line broke. We fixed it. We didn't budget for things breaking. I think we had two boilers and a water main break. None of them were budgeted, but we took money out of those funds. And we have a working budget, so we allocated additional funds to there. Part of the money went to biology, it came out of those funds. We took money out of those funds to cover their expenses.
To cover biology?
The additional allocation to biology. I think biology got the additional allocation. Physical science got the additional allocation.
Sorry. But to be clear, program fees were paid by science for that equipment. It was there. And putting it in there to pay for a boiler, that doesn't make any sense.
It's a general fund allocation. It's completely within.
That's what our argument is.
One discussion that has emerged with the board is be an elimination at universities in the state of Michigan of all program and course fees and have it rolled up immediately into a standardized tuition.
And we would support that if our biology students are paying for a boiler, then why would
so that is something I think we want to discuss moving forward, because what got us into the program and course fee charges was a shortage of funds on campus. Right? That's how program and course fees pop up around the country. Find state support. The question is, do we want to continue to do that? And I understand we have to address this need of how do we deal with emerging unknown emergency responses to academic programs that have something in the program, or something left, or some other component. That's what we want to have addressed in terms of policy moving forward. So here we are operating right now.
Okay, I just understood from Maury that we were going forward on this policy that all these program fees would go into the general fund as opposed to being distributed to accounts that are two departments that are collecting those funds.
That's up to the, that's...
So that's still being resolved.
That's being resolved, but for next year, I'm saying the proposal is to allocate all the collected funds.
To departments.
To departments, within the budget.
So the departments then after next year will be able to top those funds directly. Now we have to submit budget line items in general.
That's what's in the proposal right now.
That has to be finalized. That's something we're discussing.
Right here, bud. Right here, what?
It's the language that we have for the program.
So that's the plan. We'll get those dates up soon.
Staff.
have met since the last collegium. We'll be meeting soon for our next, I think we'll have a report for the next week.
Now, people ask me, why are these on the agenda? We don't have a lot of students. I want to get to a point, this right here, automatic thought, reporting out that in terms of these various groups on campus. Briefly, marketing update, then you want to run it down?
Sure. Marketing committee continues to meet weekly, and so we are really working on the marketing and the relation to the enrollment issues. And so we are looking, we've been doing the one day. We've got a series of door ads coming up. We've got Spectrum that's going to come up with two new television ads, as well as banner displays that we have coming across different areas. So with the door ads, we are working with our admissions staff and recruiting so, like I said, we meet once a week.
One other comment, we intentionally did a digital blitz in combination with Vantage Words this year. That's the first time we've done it. So Vantage Words went out at the same time we stepped up our digital marketing in those sectors where keywords tying those things to try to link that so publicity got Vantage Words to awareness of our institution and connect with our institution. I think that was good. We got into a couple of venues this year that I thought were really good for us. We did have some major news coverage about it. Tim Begar was a good thing. John did a good job. I'm not 100% certain potential students are listening to Begar would be able to learn, but I'm not certain if that's a direct draw between potential students. But I have to say, in the 3 years I've been here, this is the first time I had dozens of emails around the country of academic colleagues of mine, even outside of the country. Heard the NPR story and said, hey, I know where that place is. And then most people out and ask questions about how long we've been doing this thing. So that's a good thing. Let me move on then. I want to spend the remainder of time, briefly, I want to give you a comment, David, on space allocation before we get to the moment.
So things are moving forward with space reallocation. The plan was finalized. And disseminated just prior to the holidays, so you should have all gotten an email. If you have questions, please let me know. Things that have happened thus far, the school business folks have moved over to Considine Hall. If you've not been in that facility, check it out. Moving closer to having food service to complement their quarterback there, that's expected shortly. Hoping a week, but it might be two. So that's happened. CAS 123, CAS 108 beginning on Monday, and CAS 109, a loading dock, have been cleared out so that Fire Science can begin its move over to the technology and cassette building. And also conversation with academic assistants about potential realignments. And those determinations, or that determination will be made, I'll say, within the next several days. So we're chipping away at that list. There was a good decision, I think, made to have additional dialogue about the other moves that are planned, particularly with respect to what will happen in the library. And at yesterday's Provost Council meeting, I asked that the players, main players involved in all of that, get together to talk so that they can work through a best strategy for getting that stuff done. So we're moving forward.
Any questions about the space allocation?
Thank you.
Before I get to enrollment, one final comment I want to make. I appreciate everyone that sent me input about the open VP positions. I tried to respond. I think I did to everyone that sent me a note. There were some folks that saw me directly at the call, and I appreciate that. I still got additional comments on this morning for the region. With the CFO position, I intend to change that position to a position of vice president for operations and finance, so that because that role it really has a larger component in terms of operation of facilities, planning for facilities, and management. I expect to make an announcement about that shortly. I'm still still collecting input on the provost position. I would expect within the next couple of weeks here to see an announcement of the campus in terms of direction on one of those. And I'm still, I still have some dialogue to file up and follow up on with a few people. But I really appreciate the range of comments, and interestingly, very differences of opinion by employee categories of the institution. So if I were to sort those out by fact, Mr. Chancellor, in terms of responses and thoughts about those positions and their function, and how they should move forward. So expect some type of announcement on these newly formed positions for operations and finance shortly, and I would expect an announcement. Okay. Any questions or thoughts about it? Again, I appreciate the folks who took time to lay out their thoughts and bring it in. One sentence, four pages of response in terms of people's thoughts about the direction of this place. All right, lastly, I want to move on to enrollment, which is a significant and serious issue for us. A couple of things I want to mention first. I was in Detroit day before yesterday. As you know, I'm on this commission for the governor. It's very interesting, extremely stimulating discussions. We met in Detroit in conjunction with the Detroit Law Show. The time I've been to that, this is crazy event in Detroit. Very interesting. It's amazing the focus of the manufacturers on autonomous mobility. That is the laser focus of Detroit right now in terms of its future direction. Auto industries, autonomous technology in which commercial vehicles, private sector vehicles, and then amazingly in creating autonomous technology, not just driving technology, but basically artificial intelligence technology for things like military defense, was traditionally in a drone, moving toward an autonomous technology that has artificial but the relevance for enrollment, this meeting they brought in a number of global and national consulting firms to talk to us. We analyzed Michigan's, what they're described as megatrends, in relation to the U.S. and in relation to the global environment. And there's some direct relevance to our future thinking about this. We spent a fair amount of time listening to detailed discussions around Michigan's and the Midwest as a whole, accelerated urbanization, a greater movement out of rural areas. Interestingly, 30 years ago, where it was the opposite, we went out of urban centers to suburban areas and urban clusters. And you can see that happening in the UP. The population of the UP is a movement toward urban, greater density populations because of job potential and social that trend is expected to continue in Michigan. And it's interesting that Detroit is seeing a rebound in terms of population growth. It lost a million people in the recession. There's now a mega into the downtown sectors of Detroit where technology and universities are located. That is expected to be a national trend, but a trend for Michigan. It has significant impact for us to think about because we're in a rural setting. In terms of the depopulation of northern Michigan and movement gravitation of people toward Michigan's urban centers and our surrounding states. Interestingly, I was pleased to hear, this is the Republican administration, talking about the impact of climate change and resource scarcity in the Upper Great Lakes and responding to that and positioning the state for those significant changes that impact our economy. And water is front and center on this administration and in the group discussing this, which is a broad, wide sector. It has implications for what we're doing in terms of our majors and what we are focused on in terms of our science. We have a major significant component of this institution that's focused on scarcity. We're studying one of the most important resources of the region and of the state. There's relevance there. Shift in global economic powers. It was interesting that this group continued to hammer that Michigan's future labor workforce needs to be able, regardless of all sectors of labor, needs to be prepared for an aging, companies, technologies, people outside of the singular majority Michigan culture. That is a major trend and a major focus of the state. So much so that I was pleased to hear the consensus of the leading manufacturers of the people, of government personnel, saying all colleges and universities have to have a globalization, global connectivity, awareness, skill incorporated into their graduates, whether they're going to be a welder or they're going to be a business major. And demographic shifts in terms of the changes in terms of our overall population of the majority of the state. And also, interestingly, changes in technology. I'm amazed at how focused this group is on robotics. Clearly, we're positioned well for that. The state as a whole, the merging of robotics in artificial intelligence, autonomous mobility, there's a convergence of those technologies happening. The state is interested in focusing on those one. So these things have some significant thought in terms of where we're going to be in position for a moment. And one of the things that we need to ask, and I want to spend the next few minutes talking about this in this moment before, is we have ratcheted up our ambitions over the last 5, 6, 10 years. Is that correct? Those folks that have been here?
Sure.
As a strategy, when I say ratcheted up in terms of we have adopted a strategy of increasing the profile, academic profile of incoming freshmen. That has been a strategy of the institution. Right? And we have seen that movement. Our measure, our profile, the standing of our freshman class continues to climb in terms of ACT and grade point average. But we continue to shrink. And with those trends, is that the strategy we want to continue to focus on? We deny a significant number of students that would have been admitted into institutions that I have worked at, some that clearly would not, some that I haven't had. And the question is, what is the right mix in terms of students we want to admit? We're not open access. We are an access institution. Open access means all you need is a high school diploma and a curriculum to graduate from high school. And you're in. Community colleges are open access. We're not open access. But we are access. We serve first generation, we serve students from the immediate area, we serve students that may come from high schools or programs that are, may have some challenge in terms of preparing students for college, and we serve absolutely outstanding top students from class of high schools in the area. Do we have the adequate support to serve those students to the degree of success in first generation and those that are not as adequate prepared as others, and do we want to expand our focus on that or not? That is an institutional question that I think we have to address. I want you to think about that in the context of thinking about our enrollment strategy. Okay? So I'd like Matthew to give us just a brief summary of where we are. I brought this front and center because we are behind in apps. We're focusing on up our yield, but the pool is shrinking. And those trends are exactly what I just talked about for this region of the state. We have to seriously think about our strategies in terms of, we need everybody's help. Everyone in this room, attract 2 additional students, that'll get us above where we were last year. Right? It has to be a consistent institutional effort, not just one component of our campus.
Thanks, everybody. I'm going to start with just an update on the enrollment committee. So that consists of Steve and Sandy, King, Steve Johnson, Dakota Major, and Steve Kathy, and we've met myself. We've met 3 times. Fourth yesterday, but we canceled it. Received the charge from the president on Monday. I think the most important takeaway is really that committee is going to help us provide a framework for communication across campus. I think some of the enrollment numbers that are out there now, I think the positive part of what we see is eyes open and discussion forming. And in my world, that's what we hope for. This is a campus effort as it relates to enrollment. The committee will also make recommendations to admissions and other groups will establish group is coming together. We currently have a marketing director position that we're interviewing for, will interview for here shortly. And that should bring some stability and help us with that long-term planning. And the next comment I'll make is a reminder that as we sit here on day four, number one thing, if you're asking what can we do for fall enrollment, number one thing we can do is take care of those students that are sitting in class and bring them many to the young campus. If our retention rates can hold consistent or grow, that's what we need. Okay, so here we are on day four. Think about the semester. Who's missed class already? Who's going to miss class next week? About that first grade coming up. Who's jumping out at you as being of concern? We need to get that message over to Gerald is there, over to Matt's there, over to me, over that housing. Let's connect the dots with these students early. And let's be the best we can at moving that forward. So again, I'll remind you, nothing has changed in terms of our focus as it relates to enrollment. The number one thing we can do and always do is retention. That sends some numbers out, what we see in terms of spring. Currently, census data isn't here yet, but we are at about where we thought we would fall to spring. We see the same number coming through. When we have the census data here next week, we will be able to, in most ways, accurately predict how many of those students will be here next fall. Okay? So if our target is 2,100, and we take that census data number that we'll find next week, and we use traditional formulas that have been somewhat time tested, we'll know where our freshman number needs to come in. So I want to focus on fall 17 applications and admits to talk about where our fall numbers need to be with our first, second, college freshmen, transfers, and those new students we have. So what Annette said was that applications are down 14%. Big number. Okay. When we were talking last year, we figured applications would be down about 10%. So we're down a little further than we thought, but not anything that is maybe as alarming as it might be or could be. The positive is what you see in terms of admits. We're not down 9% in admits. We should be down 14%. We're not. So the applicant should be a little stronger because we have not changed and adjusted our standards at all. We want to have discussions about the initial admit program. We support all students, including those that are identified as at-risk or maybe underprepared. But certainly it's a positive thing that while we're down in applications, our yield from that application pool is a little stronger. Okay, so that's a good sign. We were not intending to make up the difference in applications. When you look at our largest declines, it is clear that it's TY1 and TY2, which is Eastern Upper Peninsula, Western Upper Peninsula. The UP numbers are essentially the result of our decline. And if you look at the state census numbers, that could have been predicted. So again, this is not an alarming. So what was our solution, or what do we hope is our solution? Well, first of all, continuing discussion, growing retention rates, doing the best we can between now and August, and doing everything we can to connect with these applicants to get a better yield. But our number one strategy to get a better return on that admit rate than we traditionally have. And that admit rate has been, what, 30%, right? Yield on admits, so we always get a certain number of admits. Of those, we get a certain number of, or a certain number of apps. Of those, we get a certain number of admits. And of the admits, we normally get a 30%. Okay. Our plan was to invest in need-based grants and adjusted scholarship opportunities. We invested $250,000 in auxiliary monies to leverage financial aid. And in the model, the small pilot we did in the spring, we saw 4-6% increase. If you had 1,000 admits last year at this time, and you got a 30% yield, 300 students. If you're at 900 admits today, which is about where we are, 100 less, 14% down, a 3% increase in yield from those admits get to the same enrollment number you were before. If we are at 4, 5, or 6%, we've had a gain. If we've grown retention by 1%, we've had a gain. Okay? We have plenty of time to make strong efforts. The number one effort we can make in this room is with the students that are on campus right now. But what this committee that I started talking about and what these sorts of meetings, what my office and other groups do with that and others, this dialogue starts today, right? Let's begin that conversation. So I know we're tight on time, but I certainly welcome comments, feedback, questions, other comments beyond what I've given to you. Shelley.
Matt, I was preparing the annual progress report for Title III I've been working on it for a while. And one of the things we track is the retention number. And so I actually want to pat everybody on the back because the common data set for last year, fall 14 to fall 15, put our retention rate of freshman, fall 15 at 63%. When I pulled the number yesterday, fall 15 to fall 16, 71.5%. So that, and so one of the things we're looking at in Title III is the outreach that our faculty do with our students. That is hugely impactful and hugely important. And so I just actually want to pat everybody on the back and say, we're making some progress. That's a big increase.
I want to just digest what Matt just said. We have a problem that our funnel is shrinking. You've got to focus on that, increasing the scope of the funnel, right? That means the number of applications you receive. That's got to be a priority. You all can help with that in terms of recruitment. But what Matt is saying is that our funnel looks kind of like this, but we're going from 100% of our applications coming over, we're only getting 33% out of that funnel. So it's a fairly tight funnel. What we want to do is change the shape so it looks more like this rather than like this and increase the yield coming in. That is a smart strategy, but that's not going to get us out of the woods entirely. We can't just focus on increasing yield if the funnel on the other end just keeps shrinking, right? So that's got to be addressed. But increasing, that isn't, which actually, that number is startling to me, 33%, is not a great success rate in terms of applications to admit. In fact, in my previous institutions, the state moved to a point on enrollment where we got report cards for the yield rate. Each time we campus presidents had to report out, we got a letter grade at intervals. Where are you on your yield rate? And that was where the focus was. Because that's where you can make the greatest change in your enrollment is on yield. The easiest, because they're already interested. They sent you an application. They already have some knowledge of what you do, why I want to be there. And move from that application of to admit is a smart strategy. But we've got to grow the funnel. And the question growing the funnel is a fundamental question that I want you to think about. I want some responses by, some rich discussion is one way to grow that funnel is to dial and change the dial on the parameters of the input. Do we want to do that or not? We have done it over the last 7 or 8 years of dialed it up. So we are denying access to students now that we didn't 10 years ago. Yes?
What are the entry requirements? I sit on selective standards and I've seen many students with ACTs below 16, which I was surprised were being admitted. So I don't know what the standards that they are.
So posted, just for the folks at home here, what the question was, what are our standards right now? 2.4 GPA? 19.
ACT or 990 SAT.
990 ACT.
But there's opportunity for admissions to make decisions to admit depending on the student's health. So if they have letters of recommendation, if they have different circumstances related to test scores, we can make that decision.
They have a 3.0 and a 17 as opposed to a 4.4.
Or 3.7 and a 15.
It's a whole
yeah, we've seen 13, yeah. Like, which is, but some of this too is adult. maybe they're coming into the campus community with years of experience in other areas. What is the validity of that support? It's still important, but does it matter? So I think these are really important discussions.
I'm going to make a comment. I'm not saying we definitely want to do this. We need to talk about this, right, in terms of what's the right thing. But having worked at institutions that are super elite, that you know are at the level of taking only, I worked at an institution where you could have a 4.0 and not get in. So you could actually get 4.5s in some high schools and some things. And I worked at institutions that are open access. And I have seen experience with students coming in with relatively low GPAs and low high school GPA and low ACTs and do well if the support is there. Not everyone. There are some that clearly that are not meant to be in college at this point in their career. The question is sorting for that. And if you take some students that are conditional, do you have a philosophy on campus and a support structure to really advise and focus on those students? Because the greatest point of success is advising more than what class do I take. But what's a syllabus? How do I navigate college? How do I address my professor, particularly with first-generation students? And one other comment I will make is that academics, particularly those with advanced degrees, tend to be around their career very successful, well-prepared students. Teresa and I talk about all the time that we didn't hang out with students that, were not well prepared in college because they disappeared, or we didn't have, and in graduate school, I didn't meet any of those students because I wasn't around them. So we'd self-select. And that needs to be some thought process about them, right? We need to talk about that as an institution now in terms of our function moving forward. And where are we willing to take some risk on students that, on quantitative data, don't fit the highest success profile nationally.
What is the average test score of our target market relative to say statewide test scores?
Question, what is our average?
What our average is, but I don't know what it is relative to the statewide without some data. It's not different.
One of the other mega trends that we heard about is there is going to be a demand of more people wanting to go to college because of sort of laddering up with credential requirements in the labor force, which means a greater number of underpaired people coming to college. Even though a shrinking in the population, a greater number of underprepared students coming to college. Do we want to address it? Do we want to shift to take some of those students or not? And how would we do it? Yeah.
I had this feeling of deja vu. I wasn't here back then, but I heard through my father, the Arbuckle years, and we appear to be having the exact same discussion that Arbuckle brought to this campus. Do we have data so that we can see what happened when we did this before? Because this
One of the differences, in my understanding, in those years, and those of you that have been here longer, was were we going to take a community college mission on more, which is different than are we going to take students who are going to earn baccalaureate degrees with a different degree of preparation, right?
That was towards the end of Arbuckle's term, but at the beginning he came in saying, He dropped the standards, and there was a lot of blowback from the professors on that, dropping the standards in his first part of his term here. And that's what Mike's referring to.
Obviously, I remember because my dad had come muttering under his breath. But as I understand, my father's bell curves for his classes went from perfect bell curve to bowls. He had a tremendous number of failures and A's, and nobody in the middle during that period of time before he retired.
That's true. I think we need to have some discussion about. I'm not saying, we cannot take on lesser prepared students without support mechanisms. I will make one comment, and I'm putting myself out of the line here. I graduated with high school with a 2.0.
had a pretty high ACT. The reason that happened is I did my own business. I was able to, at that time in high school, it was right to get released from high school to work at the workplace. I owned my own business, my own release, focused on my business. Today, I would not have gotten into the college that I got into. Those stats. Got to college, graduated with honors, got admitted to a fairly decent graduate school. And did well. Now, not all students fit that profile, but that anecdote is there are some that are worth taking some risk on in terms of how they look numerically to access college if there's some support mechanism there. For me, the support mechanism was I just had great faculty. So I was interested in anthropology and archaeology, and I was, wow, this is amazing. This is so different than high school. I'm having dinner at their homes, I'm doing things with them, I'm involved in scholarship and work. That is when, boom, changed my thought about school, right? I don't want you, I hope by making that statement, I don't think about the president's adult in terms of the academic pedigree. But I make that statement because it was interesting also at the college I went to were a few of the very, very top performing students from my high school class. Were what was called Scott IQ and their whole life and plan that flunked out. I mean, amazingly, because they got to college and there was no structure and it just fell apart immediately. So I'm just telling that story because my whole career in college, I was around extremely sharp, well-prepared, primarily students that came from second and third generation college. When I got to graduate school, there wasn't a single one of my cohort graduate students whose parents didn't have a graduate or professional degree. It's amazing. But that is a different profile than some of our students coming in. And do we want to put some energy into those students?
The discussion of the profile is a longer term discussion. It might be so that we have some short term consideration as well. But you know, financial aid leveraging is meant to address a short term need. It was addressed. Done to really be a long-term strategy and get us more in line and more competitive with other schools. We'll continue to adapt and refine that model. This is our first look at it, so I think we'll get even better at it. I wanted to clarify also that I'm not satisfied, and none of us should be, despite potentially higher yield of those events, with the application numbers that we have. It may have been expected, but in terms of, again, a longer-term strategy, plan, we need to get those numbers back to where they were. And if we've done what we're supposed to do in terms of yield of those numbers right now, and our retention numbers do the same, ultimately when those app numbers come up and we garner those same yields that we're getting now, that's our rebuild. And that takes time. But it's really these sorts of discussions and what we'll continue to see really launched by the CAFE committees
I was just curious with that number, the 70-some percent that don't come, of those, who toured and who didn't tour?
So good question. I just want to repeat that. The question was, of the 70% we lose of the apps to admit, do we have data on did they come to campus and check it out, a tour or some other activity, or not? And is that a differential factor, is what you're asking? Do we know that?
Anecdotally, we would say those that have been here, been on campus, have a higher yield than those who have never been on campus. We are contracting with a firm called Panel Research that will help us get into some of those sorts of things. But I think those sorts of questions are probably trying to really wrap our arms around. What are the different ways we can identify and get a better sense of who our applicants are, who our students are, not just our current or our future?
That's a really important question. If we have to answer that question, there are a lot of ways you could think of to incentivize students to make that first step here.
Which gets you back to the real long-term strategy beyond everything we talked about, which is engaging that 8 through 18 year old population, engaging school districts, engaging your coming back home. That is a significant thing. In that case, that is two generations of work for England. Okay, but we have to be able to see that vision and work towards it.
Have you thought about incentivizing maybe faculty and staff as well as students for summer camps? We see tremendous improvement out of our summer camps.
Absolutely. So the question was, have you thought about incentivizing faculty and staff for summer programs, camps, those sorts of things? Absolutely.
Or student scholarships.
Student scholarships, absolutely.
One of the things we are early talked about, it's sort of related to that, is incentivizing in our financial aid package some type of increased discount on summer enrollment. And that gets more people here on campus, that drives up the activity. I think one of the keys to success of recruitment during the summer is activity here in all forms. If I come here during the summer and it looks dead, and I walk around, I may be really impressed with the buildings, I may be met with a cool professor, but if I walk around and all I hear are seagulls, my reaction is this doesn't look like a dynamic university. What got me is an actual story. To go to UW La Crosse was a field school for high school students when I was 14. You may have heard me tell the story. At that time, my parents just brought me off. I lived in the dorm with college students. I was out excavating the field, and he was checking up on me, which was, that was my immediate reaction. This looks like a pretty cool environment. I didn't apply anywhere else. It was because I met a couple of professors. They were interested in me. I checked it out. I was there. It was vibrant. There were lots of exciting things happening. It was different than my hometown. From that point on, that was the only place I was going to go to college. And if I hadn't been in there, it would have been interesting. I may not have gone to school because that was where I was going to go. So that is critical. In summer camps, that was how we built, I would say, the bulk of our enrollment at our last institution was focusing on pre-college up to high school, all kinds of outreach activities. We just packed the campus during the summer with what we call camps. We call middle school, university, grandparent, university, colonomic, agriculture. It was just continuous young people on campus that took 5 or 6 years, and all of a sudden, they were all coming to us because that's the only place they had been to a university, met a professor, had that kind of interaction.
I'll remind that for 5 or 6 years, I had to remind that we had to get to that 6-year mark before we could really see the gains of the work we did. And it's hard to be patient while you get there. So, again, short and long term.
And one other comment about the pre college. Teresa, my wife, built a pre college program in Appleton. It was a grant to focus on the Hmong population. We had Zippo Hmong students at the university. It took 5 or 6 years when she started the program. She had 8 by the time we left. She had 80 with a waiting list, and we were at the whole end of the alphabet at graduation exploded. So the X, Y, Z names, all of a sudden, boom, there was a significant number. It was all because of that focus. And it was interesting that we started the program, decided the story. They were second generation Hmong students. The parents did not speak English. The original reaction in the Hmong community was this was some kind of government indoctrination program. We had to get interpreters to go to the houses, and talk with people and say, no, this is a really good thing, and it's something you want to participate in. And it paid off. What kinds of populations in our catchment area could we focus on to bring into a university environment that maybe never before even thought about the university as a possibility of something to do? That's also another potential goal. There is a significant population in the UP in northern Michigan of families that college is not even a remote possibility. Is it worth engaging those families and saying, this is a place you could come to if college has never been a discussion, never even been a remote possibility in your family's history of a discussion? We're interested in talking to you if you have what it takes, and also see an opportunity to take advantage of it. That's an intentional focus on a component of our community that I don't think we've done before.
On a side note, these conversations that come up in regards to enrollment and engaging students in investing in allocating resources, time, and energy into students that might need additional support beyond the average student. Immediately, my mind goes to how thin our faculty are spread and how many committees and requirements inside jobs that they have to take on, and the morale on campus directly relates to how much effort and how much positive energy they put into each individual student. I think before we start working on the student, we might want to work on the direct interactions that they have with faculty and people who work directly in academics that have connections with students. Maybe some sort of thought should be brought in as far as how they're even going to find the time and the resources to handle their students on the side of academics.
So, yes, do that. I will push back on that a little bit in that. Won't like this answer, but I'm going to say this. I'll be very frank. And this also was somewhat of a reflection of the comments we heard from HLC. Our workload is not above, way and beyond, the average academic community of a regional public comprehensive university. It is not in terms of our teaching loads, it is not in terms of our advising loads, and I will tell you, it is not in terms of our scholarship and our output from this institution. I'm going to be absolutely frank. There are pockets of it that we are, but the overall institution does not add up in a direct profile on those lines to comparable or smaller size institutions or even some junior colleges. There are some areas of the university where we exceeded, but there are many that we do not. We do have to focus on morale. We do have to focus on student support. But I think that there is somewhat, and I'm being very frank and honest, and I understand some people will be offended by these comments and say, what the hell is the president? No, I'm going to say that. I've worked in 7 institutions, smaller, bigger, all different types. We heard that out of the HLC because, in fact, there's very specific language about output from the institution in terms of professional development, output in terms of community service, compared to national standards. And we are shrinking the amount of committee work. So potential focus of that, focused on that, that we have meaningful committees that do meaningful work and fewer of them, maybe 30-some, moving in that direction. But I think the thought process that we are nothing but increasing the work level, we are catching up to the national standards of higher ed. That is the bottom line in my perspective on it. Now, I know to make those changes, we have to do it in a way that isn't going to wear people out. And I know that, and I'm intentional about that, and we want to be focused on that. But the bottom line, and we will see that in this report, very directed comments about scholarship, about national productivity, in terms of peer-reviewed work, of the expectations in a university setting that we need to move towards, that many of our peers have done that. Okay? Now that doesn't mean that's in everywhere, but as a generalization of an outside body coming in and looking at us, those are some very observant dialogue that they have with me, and I can see the language of it in the report. But I'm absolutely sensitive to what you're saying. And what I really don't want people to feel is they're not appreciated. They are.
Well, and I think that's part of what I'm saying. And I appreciate your response. Like, I think you should be open and honest. I don't think we should, sugarcoat anything in conversation. But I think when you have the perception of that, I think there's some work that needs to be done as far as maybe changing that perception around campus. And maybe making it a little bit more positive in the morale direction and getting faculty on board with that. Because I think saying to somebody, you're not taking on more, and then still feeling that way, I think that's...
I would not say that. People are taking on more.
No, I'm just saying, like, when you refer to the national averages of, the workload and the output and that sort of thing, I appreciate that, and that's fine. The numbers are the numbers. But, I mean, when you have that perception from a group of people, the perception has to change, or the feeling has to change.
Agree, and I need your help as the president to address that. I want to hear from you of ideas, things we can do, things I can do better to make people feel better about their contributions and the institution. And I will focus on it, but I need it. I have some ideas. Try to focus on those ideas. I need help. The other thing that was an absolute consistent theme with the visit is our need to have greater connectivity with the outside world in higher ed. That's one thing people ask me, why do you send us all these articles? I don't send it to keep you busy. I don't expect you to read every one. But I do it because I try to select things that I think, if I was an academic, if I'm working in a university, that shed some light on trends and activities and things that are happening around us that we need to know about. That's what, for me, these discussions and this panel that I'm on are so intellectually stimulating, because I'm sitting with people, not just from Michigan, but around the country, that are thinking about and talking about emerging trends that have immediate impact on where we're positioned. That is absolutely relevant. We can't take the position that we just, you know, live in this area, we do our work, and whatever happens around us in terms of trends is relevant. We just focus on doing our thing and everything will be fine. That isn't, and that has harmed us for that thought process.
What I think, doing that around campus, you saw professional development or educational sessions throughout the year. Maybe something that could get folks more to speak or on board.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because tonight, if you have a chance to go to Starving the Beast, and if you can't come tonight, you can't be a part of that discussion, to watch that film, because that will give you a very good insight in some dramatic changes to higher ed that we need to be thinking about that are impacting us here.
I think that what you're saying is great, but I think that the last comment regarding the connection to the outside world will naturally grow with the idea that the first idea you had, the technology and integration and so forth, looking at what's going to be needed. And you left it the middle comment about, do you let the students from the UP? The answer is yes.
Absolutely.
So I'm saying to you, yes, yes, yes. And I mean this constructively, but I'm surprised we're asking this question. The answer is yes.
So we need to
intentionally be doing this. Yes,
to focus on. And when I say we want the students of the UP, absolutely. Do we want to engage students in the UP and families that college is completely off the map of possibilities or remote as a possible? We haven't intentionally done that. I have worked at places where we did that. We selectively went after large segments of the population that were outside of the normal realm of colleges and trajectory. Man, we got some amazing students that came out of that world that when they got to college, it changed their lives forever. But it also required some tremendous resources to be dealing with families and parents. What's a syllabus? How do I go to college? How do I do that? Yeah.
I'd like to go back to the tours for a minute as an example. So I think we need to know how many prospective student tours each program is doing, and then what they're seeing from those. What's the conversion rate? Because I know faculty that are giving 30 to maybe 50 tours a year. That's obviously a week or more of work. Can they replace that? Can they be just as effective by going, making one trip to some large school downstate and recruiting? And save themselves, you know, 2-day trip, save themselves 3 days' work and recruit as many more students. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what we're getting by doing 30 to 50 student tours a year.
These are tours here on campus.
Effective student tours. Is that time better spent elsewhere? What are the other actions I can take to improve enrollment? I need to know.
I think this Hanover firm that we're working with, we can provide them with the raw data. They can help us develop a
structure for asking very fine-grained questions about what our results, what our efforts are, and what the result is, which can then be used to say, that's a really good strategy, but that's really wasting your time on this. That includes how we interact with students once we get them here, but the kind of students we go after and the kinds of initial contacts we have.
We can go look at,
we should probably wrap up.
Those 70% students who don't come, that submit an application, we can go look and see where they went. But that's the idea, you know, so those are the things, let's track and follow through.
I hear what you're saying. I as a faculty need to know where my time is best spent on improving enrollment. Because I have a strategy right now, and I don't know if it's any good. I have no idea.
I would say your area is working.
But I can't tell you why.
I
should have known.
Is that the answer?